I am D Nichols. She, her are my pronouns. I will accept they, them as well. Currently, I'm based in Memphis, Tennessee, but by the time people hear this, I will be based in Chicago. And currently, the reason that I'll be based in Chicago is because I'm currently a senior UXR or UX researcher at YouTube, aka Google, and I chose to relocate back to the Midwest.
Let's start from the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in rural Mississippi. I was born in Chicago, but my mother moved my older brother and I to Mississippi, to the Delta, to Cleveland, where my elders are, where my grandparents still live today. And that area definitely was formative for all the work that I do today. In many ways, rural America is a microcosm of all the issues that we witness and experience in larger cities, in the larger context of society at large. And that was definitely the case for me too.
So in Mississippi, how was your experience in school? Were you encouraged to be a creative person, or what were you encouraged to do and be when growing up in school?
So in Mississippi, they have they used to have a program called Project Pass. And it's for students who are tested as gifted students. And so I was in the gifted student program as a kid, which meant that I had to go to two schools at the same time. I went to my school because it was the Black school. It was the school on my side of town. But then I was bused over to another town where I got all of this extra enrichment. And I was learning about, Roman and Greek gods and third grade, and that was definitely something that I wasn't exposed to in my school. And so my early education gave me a glimpse of what folks call like Black exceptionalism, and like being a good Negro and young, gifted, and Black, like all of that stuff. But it also made me realize that I had to balance like being me, like being fully me. And that came with a lot of bullying. A lot of students did not like that I was Black and smart, and not, humble about it. As a kid, I'm like, I'm that chick who is raising my hand at every question. And I didn't shy back from that. And so I got into a lot of fights. I was supported in the sense that my teacher saw something more in me than just defending against bullies. And they did nurture my creativity, but it wasn't necessarily just visual craft that they were nurturing. I got a lot of that from home, from my family, especially my grandmother. What they nurtured in me, I believe, was the power of the narrative and learning how to write and be a storyteller. I definitely got that from my teachers.
Your family nurtured your more creative visual craft. Is there anything that, like, did your family members also have a visual craft of their own that you were able to learn from and experience?
No. My grandmother, I would say, was the most creative person in my family growing up. She was a doll maker, and she's a writer too. She writes a lot of the eulogies, like for funerals, and it has like made her rise to this level of prominence in our hometown, because everyone goes to her when they want their story, their life story celebrated and done well. I come from a family of ministers, so we're all really great at the spoken word. But when it came to visual arts, they more so just recognized a curiosity and a talent within me early on. And at first I got in trouble for doing things like writing and drawing doodles on my great grandmother's walls. But every single Christmas, every single birthday, they were gifting me with the tools, with crayons, with markers, with everything that I needed in order to bring all of my ideas in my head to life. And so as a kid, I would keep this little red notebook of poems and stories and all the books that I wanted to write. But in there, I would also illustrate the characters in that. And yeah, my family saw that and just kept nurturing it.
So what happened mm-hmm. after high school? Where did you go to college? Did you relocate? Did you leave Mississippi?
If I could skip back a little bit, my mom was a single mom. She moved my brother and I from Mississippi to Memphis when I was in fifth grade. And that more so catapulted a lot of the creative energy, because in Memphis, we had schools that could, that, you know, that had arts programs. And I ended up going to a creative and performing arts high school. That's when I really like started to find my visual voice, of going from just the ideas in my head and really connecting the dots between different histories that I knew about Memphis. Like, you know, Memphis is one of the bedrocks of the civil rights movement. This is where Dr. King died, was murdered. And so there's a legacy here that my art teachers in high school really nurtured. And so when I was ready to transition to college, I ended up getting like a full academic ride to WashU in St. Louis in order to further like develop my visual voice, but not as an artist, instead as a communications designer or a graphic designer. And a big part of that was realizing that, and this came from my mom, who's like, you know, in business, she's like, yo, find the creative thing that you can do that can also lead to a career. And so pivoting from visual art to design in college was that critical point, because that introduced me to a whole new language, a whole new ball game of possibilities. But even on campus, I was a student organizer. And so that link between visual practice and injustice and just like social change at large, that was always linked in my journey there too. And even during my senior thesis, one of my professors looked at my body of work and he was like, you should not be a designer. You should be someone out there working with the people. And as hurtful as that was at the time, he was right, because I ended up going on this journey of working with the people and using design as that catalyst to elevate other people's visual voices for social change.
So what was your transition from being a designer, working strictly in design, to working with the people and incorporating design into that?
I'd gotten accepted to be a teacher with Teach for America. And right before the Summer Institute, I quit. And it was just a gut feeling that, man, I should not be going into the classroom. Like, there's more that I want to do. And with that transition, I ended up getting accepted into this program called Project MLab. And in that program, they take young designers and they plant us in rural America, or like some place that's kind of off the map. And for, you know, half of the summer, we have to go in as social entrepreneurs, as design entrepreneurs, and help that community problem solve its issues. You know, back then that sounded like a glorious opportunity of like someone who likes social change and community service and stuff. But it was transformative in the sense of opening my eyes to that type of savior mentality that existed amongst or within the field. And my cohort ended up getting kicked out of a neighborhood. And I left that experience being like, I want to do this work, but I want to do it where I'm not causing harm, where I'm not necessarily fueling the same type of trauma that people are already experiencing. So I ended up transitioning to grad school where I studied social work. The Brown School at WashU, so I went back to St. Louis to that school. It really gave me the space to learn how to do this work well and do it right.
Do you have any advice, just based off of your experience of transitioning into social work, for people who have these interdisciplinary or these multidisciplinary interests, but feel like they should go up one path because that's what they've been told by their parents or family or just the world around them? Like, what would you tell someone who wants to explore and do something wildly different?
You know, I would tell them to be entrepreneurial about it. In my program, I was a misfit, and I had to be comfortable with being a misfit. And taking the using the resources and leveraging the connections that I had in order to define and carve the work that I wanted to do. Because back then, the field of like social the title of social impact designer, that didn't exist in anybody's job descriptions. And so in order to carve that lane for myself, I had to hustle. I had to put it into practice. And I think one of the things that young designers who are at that intersection or trying to make, you know, a crossroad between two passions that they have is that, yeah, you might find yourself positioned in one thing or one area, but don't be afraid to bring that other into it and start really experimenting with what a whole new thing could look like. I'm a big music lover and remix culture. I would say apply that to the field, to the things that you're passionate about. Take those two things that seem disparate, mash them up, and create something beautiful. That was definitely part of my journey, but it came with a lot of openness to learning both sides. Like when you're trying to merge two things, you have to be good at connecting the dots and seeing where those disparate moments are actually opportunities for either something new or a fusion that is better than the individual parts.
I love that. So how did the School of Social Work teach you how to be a better leader? Because you're coming out of an experience where leadership and helping others was really taken on with a savior complex. So how did the School of Social Work help?
Yeah, there were so many ways. One thing that I will highlight though is, especially with the Brown School of Social Work, it's the number one school for social work in the United States. And it is very good at bringing in experts who can help nurture the various facets of what any of the students' passions might be. And it's also good at convening thought leaders for us to engage with. And so when I was a student, my first year of grad school, the Clinton Global Initiative came to St. Louis and WashU hosted it. And my academic deans, my advisors, they made sure that we were involved. And that platform pushed me into the national spotlight because I was leading, I had two projects that were a part of the Clinton Global Initiative back then. And so I think the School of Social Work was a catalyst for me going beyond the local scene and really connecting with all of these people across the nation and in some ways across the world in order to learn best practices and do it well, like do this work well.
Can you talk a little bit about those projects you were working on?
Design Serves was the DServe project. It was the first project that was a part of the nonprofit that I started in grad school, which was Catalyst by Design, which then pivoted as a for-profit called Civic Creatives that I led since 2013. Design Serves had a very simple mandate of teaching young people in our local neighborhoods design skills so that they could help envision and enable new prototypes of what community living could entail. By the time I pitched it to be a part of the Clinton Global Initiative, I had a team. We had partnerships. We had done the work to really set it up for success. And we ran a few cohorts of that program. And at the same time, I was really into storytelling. So I was hosting this monthly storytelling night called United Story, of just bringing people from different perspectives on a topic to, you know, have an open mic about what their personal experiences have been, not necessarily what their opinions are. And so we did a few iterations of United Story, and we pitched that to the Clinton Global Initiative as well, and that got selected. And so those two projects, you know, really defined my grad school experience, but they also led to the firm that I ultimately created.
Wow, that is so, so cool. Okay, so what comes after grad school?
A few things came out of that. One was a double life, because while I was, while my team and I were founding Catalyst by Design, which is now Civic Creatives, I was also working full-time as a museum educator at our contemporary art museum, leading like community and school programs. And so I had access to all of these art supplies. I even had my own art bus that I would drive around town in order to do projects in public with people. And after grad school, I was gonna move, but I stayed in St. Louis for a few more months. And in August of that year, this was 2014, on August 9th, that's when Mike Brown was murdered. And so as a person freshly out of grad school, equipped with a lot of leadership skills, I hit the ground running with a team of artivists once the protests broke out in Ferguson. And I was able to help supply protesters on the ground with art supplies to make their posters and stuff on the spot. But we also formed the Artivist Collective. And between August 9th of 2014 and the end of 2015, we had already created or co-created over 80 projects with protesters and activists and community members across the region. There was a lot of work that we were doing, and a lot of that got national attention. One of those projects, the Mirror Casket, even got collected by the Smithsonian. And the seven of us who are on that core team, a lot of us are still doing this same type of work today. I'm still organizing. I'm a core organizer of Designist Protests. So instead of just organizing with other artists, I'm organizing with designers across and within the design field. The spirit of all of those three lives as entrepreneur, designer, artist, and you know, social worker coming together, like that has been like such a defining identity to have in this space, in this world. And that's shifting right now. Like I said, I just joined Google. Like I just went corporate by joining the YouTube team. But in many ways, I'm still doing a lot of the same work within this team, centering racial justice. But instead of just doing it in the built environment with all of my you know, comrades with Designist Protests and the artivists, I'm also doing this work in the digital space. So thinking about the virtual environment.
And so before we get into your corporate work, I did want to ask about just balancing being an organizer and also working full time. When I hear this and when other young people hear this, a lot of times we think about our livelihood, like, you know, our well-being, like how do you take care of yourself? Like how do you make sure that you're able to have food on the table but still be available to the folks in Baltimore when there's something that, you know, you've been called for? So can you speak a little bit to how you support your livelihood, balancing all of these identities and all that you do?
The livelihood part came easy. By being an entrepreneur, by having a design firm that was centered on not just like the aesthetics of what something could be or the theory of what something could be, but like the strategy, the action. We took a BOGO approach. We asked our clients to help select which one of the initiatives that we're working on the ground, do you want us to use a portion of this revenue to support? And so by instituting this sense of like, all of this money that we earn is not for us, a portion of this goes back to community, that was a sustainer. That was a model that that worked very well, because that meant that not only could I dedicate my time to being on the ground with people and being like quote unquote pro bono, that also meant that I wasn't just bringing like my time, I was bringing money, I was bringing treasure, I was bringing resources and skills and sometimes other people along the way. But you know, came with a lot of sacrifice. I was not always good to myself back then. Burnout was real. I stretched myself way too thin to the point where I wasn't able to take good care of my physical self, my, you know, my romantic self, my, like, my love life. I've never been in love. I haven't had, you know, relationships that have lasted because I was such a workaholic back then and didn't allow space to be soft. I was always like just focused on everything else, and I thrived. Like, you know, I was celebrated. I had a lot of fun. I traveled a lot. I loved the freedom of that, but that came with that sacrifice of that, of nurturing something that it took me so long to realize was missing and that I needed. Like that sense of companionship, someone to come home to and just be with without an agenda, you know? It made me realize that there were a lot of folks in my life who I was valuable to only because of what I could do for them or what I could create with or for them. And that became too transactional for me. And so my mental health was not well with making all of those realizations. And my physical self was not well. Throughout all of that, I had fibroids, very bad, and endometriosis, and a lot of like stress-induced like gut issues that I still feel to this day. And by summer of 2019, I ended up getting a hysterectomy because the fibroids had formed around my ovaries so dramatically that it was pressing on my bladder and my pelvis and all of my, like, all of these other body parts. And I was in excruciating pain all the time. I was just like forcing myself to push through the pain, and I cracked. And those were the moments where I realized like something has to change. This life that I've made, that I've loved, is not sustainable for my health. And so I quit everything. And I decided then and there that I was going to treat myself to a vacation in South Africa. I decided during that time that I would write an application for the Loeb Fellowship at Harvard, at the GSD. But I ended up getting the fellowship at Harvard and quit everything. Ended up getting the hysterectomy the summer of 2019, and that changed my life. The sense of energy, the sense of like focus, clarity around who I really wanted to be, all of that like just started to manifest itself. And I was like, entrepreneurship is no longer for me. This hustle, this grind, it's not what I want to do. I want to make space to still be able to do this work with passion, but not be burdened by carrying so much of the load and wearing so many of the hats. And my role now at Google, I got one job, research, you know, like do this one thing and do it well. And I'm just in a better place because of that.
I want you to speak a little bit to the pros of stepping away and stepping away from your own pride even to work with or work for someone else that gives you more time to have a life.
For me, it's balance. It's realizing that I can let some of my ego of my name being on everything, I can let that go. I have done well with my journey. I am proud of the work that I have done with others. And I can allow myself the grace to not always be that person, be that version of myself. And so stepping into this pivot has been seamless. You know, it has been liberating to go work for someone else, primarily because everything that I've done has led to this point, has equipped me for this role that I have. I can't speak a lot about what I do at YouTube for a lot of reasons, but I will say that I didn't, even though I let my practice go, I didn't stop being an entrepreneur. The role that I have is brand new to this company, and I get to be an entrepreneur. I get to help create something within this space that will have just as much impact, if not more, because we're scaling, you know, we can scale globally. I think it's less of like a give take, like what did I lose, what did I gain? And it's more of like, how do I balance? How do I hold this? And so giving, like going to work for someone else, I think I had to articulate my conditions in order to make the case for me being there and it being a fit for me. And part of that was, I'm not gonna wear more than one hat. I'm coming into this space. Here's the job description. I will do this part well. Here's what I feel my value is. And if you've heard about Google, they are generous. Perks. I earned more than I would have ever earned by myself, like running my firm. And I can say that and not feel shame or embarrassment about that, because this is a huge company. But the thing that I would say to someone is, like, you really have to know yourself. You have to know where you are in your life and what will fulfill you in this life, in whatever season or chapter that you're in. And for me, in this chapter, I want to nurture love. I want to nurture and cultivate family. I want to breathe a little bit. I don't want to hustle all the time. A lot of that back then, and still now, is glorified. You know, burnout culture, being booked and busy, people glorify that stuff. And what I realized after doing it for so many years and being on the go all the time was that rest is just as important. That I am no good if my tank is empty. And finding the role or the position that will allow you to exist and bring your full self into any space, I think that is the goal.